Hello, and welcome to Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else,
a series of conversations with innovative educators at colleges and universities across the country and around the world.
This podcast is produced by faculty and staff in the Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Faculty Development at Xavier University of Louisiana.
And now, let's talk about teaching, learning, and everything else.
This is Bart Everson, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Jane Compson, who is on the faculty of the University of Washington, Tacoma campus. Dr. Compson got her PhD in comparative religion from the University of Bristol, and more recently got her second master's in philosophy, concentrating on bioethics, from Colorado State. She's working on projects related to self-care and stress management for healthcare professionals, also documenting local efforts for environmental justice, as well as doing work on mindfulness theory, in addition, of course, to her responsibilities as a teaching faculty member. So, Dr. Compson, thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Well, I'm wondering if you could tell us, we were going to, you know, you came to my attention just recently as I came across a chapter that you have in a book called Meditation in the Classroom. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could, before we get into that, if you could just tell us about what classes you teach, and in particular, you know, classes that are relevant to teaching online, but also to a contemplative approach.
Okay, yes, sure. First of all, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be talking, and thanks for this work that you're doing, which is wonderful. So I teach classes in the intersection, really, between religious studies and philosophy. So I teach classes in environmental ethics and in comparative religion and introduction to ethics. But the one where I really use a lot of contemplative practices, the most actually, is a class that ironically is fully online. I say ironically because it's kind of, you don't typically think of the online space as being very conducive to doing contemplative practice, but that was a challenge, so I figured I'd take it. And that class is called Philosophy, Religion, and the Environment. So we look at different attitudes, different worldviews towards the environment and how that varies across traditions and times and cultures.
Well, that sounds very interesting. We have been trying to promote contemplative pedagogy in this podcast, in some of our faculty development efforts here at the Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Faculty Development. But I'm wondering, either, you know, there's still probably some listeners out there who don't know what we're talking about exactly. So I'm wondering if you could help us understand what does contemplative pedagogy, what does that mean to you?
That's a great question. I think it's you know, it's a complicated question, and it can mean different things to different people. But to me, I guess I would say that it focuses not just on the logical and rational part of learning, which we're all very familiar with. When we go into a classroom, we expect a strong emphasis on logic and rationality, and that's all fine and good. I'm not criticizing that at all, but sometimes that can, I feel that I'm studying something or reading about something, and I feel that part of me is not engaged in that, and the part of me that's not engaged can be the one that's more I don't know, affective, I suppose, or emotionally based, or thinking about like how I relate to the things that I'm learning about. So rather than having a focus on objectivity, contemplative pedagogy opens the door to exploring our subjective interactions with the things that we're engaging with. So it's opening the door to not just your head, but also to your heart, I guess, is another way of putting it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was just all the stuff that you were saying there is making me think this is kind of a way of teaching from the heart or to the heart, or just involving the heart in matters a little bit more.
Right.
The metaphorical heart, of course.
Yes.
And I think you're right. That does seem kind of counter to my idea of online. The online experience seems like a very kind of, sometimes, especially with an online course, it seems more conducive to other other modalities. And I'm wondering then, how can you do that online?
Yeah, that's a great question. That was a question I asked myself. In fact, when I was first asked to teach online, I was a little bit skeptical about it. And especially a class about environment and our relationship with the environment, I just thought it was so ironic that, you know, in a lot of the writers we look at talk about a sense of alienation or disconnection from the natural world. And here I was teaching this class from behind a computer screen to other human beings who I wouldn't even see. A lot of my students I've never actually met in person who take this class, talking about the natural world, and, you know, they could technically do the whole class from just behind their screen. So it was ironic. But I really, at this point in my teaching career, felt that the contemplative part of things was so important, both for me as a teacher and also in terms of our human investigations and relationship with the environment. I felt that you cannot leave out the affective, emotional, relational part of that. So that was my challenge, to do it online, and I was skeptical about whether that would work. But funnily enough, I found that some of the things about teaching online have made it kind of, some of the what might be seen as pitfalls of online have actually been an advantage. For example, sometimes when I do in-person contemplative exercises with students, they can be a little bit inhibited and shy because it's, you know, it's an unusual thing to be asked to do, and they feel like kind of exposed. I've noticed that when students are in the online space, they're usually by themselves, and they can be much more frank and open about their experience. They feel less inhibited. They spend more time to write about what they're experiencing, and that the anonymity of online gives them permission, I think, to delve a little bit deeper. So once I began to realize that, I started playing more and more with using contemplative practices, and found it to be really fruitful, actually. And the student feedback has been really, really positive. And certainly as a teacher, I see that the things that they're writing about, the perspectives they come out with, can be really like moving and show a real development of ideas and a relationship and a shift in their attitudes. So it does work, but you have to, I've learned over the years different ways of honing it to become more effective, I guess.
Oh, great. Yeah, and we definitely have time, hopefully, to get into some of that honing that you've done in a moment. What you just said did strike me. The idea of solitude is certainly something that you know, we see associated with a lot of the contemplative traditions. And there is something about the online student, I guess, that is kind of solitary. It is a solitary experience sitting there in front of the computer, as you noted. I was also, of course, this is the subject of that your chapter in Meditation in the Classroom. And one thing that you mentioned that really got my attention there was the idea of being present when you're physically not present.
Yeah.
And the irony of that.
Yeah.
And in particular, you even mentioned that students can't hear your accent, your British accent.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Which is funny because that's always such a feature, either like it or not, that's always something students, like in America at least, obviously, associate with me. And sometimes a little irritating on final, you know, student teaching evaluations. They ask, you know, you ask for feedback and they will say things like, oh, I love your accent. but you realize that, so, you know, so much of my classroom work, my classroom craft, I suppose, when I'm doing face-to-face teaching, relies on little things like that, you know, the kind of dynamics between the student, the relationships between us, right? And that element of relationship has been taken away, the kind of embodied part. So I also wondered how that would affect things too, you know, the kind of student-teacher relationship would be quite different. And indeed, it is very different. But I
was just going to say, I think that may be something that scares some faculty away from teaching online, is the fact that they won't be physically present, that's what they're used to, and that there is a certain confidence in that. So perhaps a contemplative approach might be a way for a faculty member who has a lot of deep misgivings about going online. The contemplative approach might really help that faculty member.
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the things about a contemplative approach is not just, exploring the relationship with the subject matter, but also exploring one's own reactivity and one's own emotions as a student, as an inquirer. And I think that includes being a teacher, one's own relationship with teaching. So I guess all of those misgivings you talk about, worries that you anticipate people might have, I mean, I definitely experience all of those. But one of the things I found to be really helpful for me, and I think for the students as well, it seems to be the case from their evaluations, is that you try to use those areas of discomfort as a teachable moment, right? You don't ignore them, you acknowledge them. So when we talk about one of the modules, we talk about alienation from the environment. And one of the discussion questions I have the students write about and reflect on and think about is, well, what do you think? Do you see the irony of studying this topic in an online forum? And what do you feel about teaching online classes? And do you have the sense of alienation? And what's that alienation feel like? And what's the difference from being in the face-to-face classroom? And what does this tell you about community and relationships? And so that becomes a lens for exploring our own reactivity and our own, it just becomes a teachable moment, I guess. And for me too, I tend to self-disclose about what it's like for me as a teacher. And that's really usually that kind of honesty, that sincerity about how we're all in this together and exploring this together can actually, ironically, build up quite a good sense of community. Because, we're looking at our human reactions, not just the kind of formal, hey, I'm the teacher, you're the student, just do what I say. It becomes more of a collective inquiry, I guess.
And maybe we can get specific then. Maybe if you could share with us some of the techniques that you've actually used, the specific techniques that you've used to attempt a contemplative pedagogy online. I'm wondering if you could tell us about some of the specific assignments.
Sure. So, if I made it, like four kind of principles that I found are really helpful, and I'll just mention those and then give you an example with particular things that I do. So, the four principles are like having a grounding. So, getting a foundation for these practices, using a form throughout the class where they're weaved in all the way through. Integrating them through every step of the class, so they're not just like a kind of add-on. So that's the third thing. And then the fourth thing is, assessments, and making sure that they are like, an integral part of the class that is assessed. So in terms of grounding, what I mean by that is I think it's really important to start right from the beginning of the class by explaining to students that there is this contemplative element, contemplative pedagogy that will run throughout the class, and what the heck is it? So I assume they know absolutely nothing about that, and that they may be some that kind of like a little bit suspicious of it and unfamiliar with it. And I give them a reading to do called Opening the Contemplative Mind in the Classroom by Tobin Hart. And I think that's a really wonderful kind of theoretical explanation of why contemplative practices have a place and are useful. And he also gives some little exercises that students can experiment with, like deep listening or not doing or mindfulness exercises. So I have students read that so they get the rationale. And then I have them try one of these exercises and reflect on that. So right from the beginning, they are with me in terms of, why are we doing this? So I try to make it really transparent to them. And also they're experimenting straight away. And I think it's very important to be very allowing of the student experience and of the fact that they might feel, well, this is kind of crazy. In fact, what I often do is talk about the experience of previous classes of students. And I say that a lot of them say at the beginning, okay, this seems really crazy and off the wall. And how by the end, they 90% of the time come around and say, wow, that was really powerful and helpful. And so I kind of try to normalize the fact that if you're feeling this is really unusual, just try to stay with it. It's normal. It's okay. Look into that. Why do you think you're feeling like that? And just kind of, you know, really give them the space to explore. So I guess that's the first thing is theoretical kind of foundations and something to practice with, first of all, and then a forum in which they can discuss that with me and with each other, but where they feel safe to say they're, you know, not sure about it or, you know, worried or this was weird or whatever. My experience has been that they're really willing to talk about that, share that, and how they write kind of neat and interesting things to each other about shared experiences. So that's the first thing. Then in terms of form, I try to choose practices, I guess, obviously, in a way, that match with the subject matter. So this is a class about relationships with the environment. So the kind of inaugural exercise they do is plant a seed. And I guide them through a kind of mindfulness of the seed exercise and then encourage them to, like, reflect and take time to feel and experience what it's like to really slowly plant the seed, look at it, observe it, see what emotions and feelings arise for them, and then plant it and just reflect upon that. They often think it's kind of really out of left field, but they do it and they say, that was kind of interesting. I haven't done this since I was a kid, and it was really amazing to think that this seed has all this potential, and it's just really neat. They get onto, there's a bit more space for just talking about their emotions, their feelings. And then as we go through each module of the class, I try to tie this experience back. I try to, like, have references back to this seed planting experience. So they'll be talking about the progress of, or not in some cases, of their seed as we go through the class. But it's always tied into one of the readings or the topics we've had for that week. So we have one reading by an author called Satish Kumar, who talks about concepts of individuality and cooperation in ecology, and how he favours the model of kind of cooperation rather than the Darwinian idea of competition. And he illustrates this with the story of a plum seed, and how when he plants a plum seed, the plum's ego, the seed's ego, is broken by the fact that it has to kind of dissolve in order to, its shell dissolves in order to mix with its environment and create this sapling. So all of this ties into this the students' own reflections and their own experiences with planting a seed, but it also connects with the readings and the higher level concepts such as ideas of identity, individuality, cooperation. So I guess the two are the themes need to be integrated with what you're studying, obviously. So integration is really important. And the other thing is that structurally, I try to have consistency throughout the course. So in each module of the course, students will have their set readings, then they do quizzes and what I call like conventional discussion assignments on a prompt. But they always have also a contemplative assignment that goes with that module, so that they know each week that they can expect this is going to be reinforced, this theme is going to be reinforced all the way through the course. And then at the very end of the class, their final paper has a section where they're asked to integrate their own learning journey through the contemplative practices into the kind of main body of the paper. So that all the way through, the contemplative exercises aren't just a kind of add-on, they are, you know, a substantive part of their inquiry. So I think that's been effective for me, to really kind of take them seriously and really run them all the way through, not just make them little extras that I, you know, just like icing on the cake, but they're part of the cake, if you see what I mean. And then yeah. the last piece is assessment, and assessment is when they do what they do for their contemplative exercises is they just write. They basically free write, and I also encourage them to use other media, like they can draw or they can send me photos. Sometimes students write poems. They write their reflections about these experiences, and although they get a grade for they get a pass/fail grade for those particular assessments, I don't. It's just pass/fail because I want students to feel not kind of judged on their own personal reflections, but I want them to do it. So for those, it's pass/fail. And that actually, you know, I was worried that might make students like just blow it off or just write one or two lines. And sometimes that happens, it's true. But most of the time, actually, they seem to really thrive in that sense of freedom. Right. And so often they'll write quite long, very interesting, sometimes quite moving reflections. So even though they're not getting like formal letter grades or number grades for those assignments, apart from, you know, whether they did it or not, they don't tend to exploit that in terms of just being lazy about it. There's some really deep, interesting writing that happens. Yeah, otherwise I found it kind of difficult to know how to, when someone is really disclosing deep thoughts or emotions, it just sort of felt weird to be saying, yeah, hey, that's a B, or, you know, it didn't feel quite right. So, I grade them slightly differently than I do the regular discussions, which might get, you know, an A, a B, or a C, or whatever.
Well, grading is a whole can of worms that we should really do an episode about that sometime.
Right.
I'm wondering, first of all, that sounds like a fascinating course. I would love to, I think I would love to take that course. But I'm wondering also, well, thank you. I wonder if you have encountered any, pitfalls. You talked a little bit about how students might perceive this at first, and I think that's a concern with contemplative pedagogy across the board, although what we find usually is that students are very receptive.
Right.
There's, especially since that wasn't how I was educated, and it's
right.
hard for me to even imagine that in my undergraduate
right.
milieu back in
exactly.
the late 1980s. It just
yep.
would have been, I think... I just can't imagine. But I'm
yeah.
wondering if you've experienced any other challenges or pitfalls, either with students or maybe with colleagues or administrators, or anything that you feel like you learned from along the way that might be beneficial to our listeners to hear about.
I feel kind of fortunate. I keep waiting for that to happen, especially I feel worried about whether people might say this is somehow quasi-religious or... You know, it's not, it's sort of beyond my remit as a faculty member. You know, this is just private emotions and it's nothing to do with, you know, what you're meant to be learning. I kind of have expected to get that. But actually, I've been doing this now for, let's see, about 10 years. And that's yet to happen. So that's really great. I think part of it is being really upfront about why, right at the beginning, why we're doing this. Sometimes I suppose pitfalls are I get students who just don't take it seriously, right? Who are just like, right, just kind of blow it off and, you know, aren't that interested in writing about it and, you know, just don't really see the point or... but then you can get that about, you know, whatever you're teaching in whatever way you're doing it. There's always some times when the student's just not like into it or not ready to hear it. So I wouldn't say I get that with the contemplative stuff any more than I do with any of the kind of more traditional pedagogical techniques I use. Pitfalls, I think sometimes it hasn't worked in the past when I've, or hasn't worked as well when I haven't integrated it into the course all the way through. So it's just seemed just sort of an add-on. Don't think that is very effective when that happens. And I think sometimes my tendency has been to be a little apologetic about it because I feel kind of nervous about, oh, there's this thing and you're probably going to think this is really weird. And hey, and so that almost sets students up to have the same kind of attitude, like, what is this crazy thing we're doing? I felt more confident about that and expressed it, you know, given it more weight. And just sort of been okay, it's okay to come out about the fact that you're a multidimensional being who's not just like you're not a disembodied brain walking around. You've got emotions and a heart and a body. And I think the climate's more and more conducive to that, though. I agree with you that it was unthinkable during my undergraduate years. So far I keep waiting for the potential pushback, but so far... so good. Knock on wood.
Well, that's great to hear. That's a confidence booster for people who might be thinking about something like this. Well, we are kind of towards the end of our time limit here, so mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's any final thoughts or stuff that I should have asked you, but I didn't.
I think that one of the things that I found really important for me, and this is one of the reasons I'm so happy to have this talk with you and the work that you're doing, is to have a supportive community who are also interested in contemplative pedagogy. For me, that really, when I go through sort of times of doubt, I can get such a sort of charge of my battery by reading or especially going to conferences where there are other faculty who are doing contemplative pedagogy, and also really focusing on my own contemplative practice helps this to kind of come more organically from me rather than just going through the motions. And with our, as I'm sure you know, with our busy lives, that's easy for that to go by the wayside. But I think the more that I'm doing my own foundational contemplative practices, the more naturally it comes from me and the better a contemplative teacher I am. So I guess that's important, but I don't always practice what I preach, sadly. So yeah, community and foundation in your own practice, I think are two things that I aspire to, but don't always manage to get.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Constant, for your time and for speaking with us today. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me too. Thank you very much, and thank you for your work.
Thanks for listening to this installment of Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else.
For more information, please visit our website at cat.xula.edu.
That's cat.xula.edu.
Until next time, keep on teaching, learning, and everything else.